A voice of reason. Well edited.
My name is Katie Spielman. I'm calling from Charleston, South Carolina. My motto really is only five words and is somewhat pessimistic. We haven't hit bottom yet.
Five words, six words, a motto to get this nation over the bumps of 2009. Let's hope they're just bumps. Join the bottom feeders and select a motto for America. Six words, optimism, welcome. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Adora Udoji is away. Jerome Vaughn of WDET in Detroit is here with us. Good morning, Jerome.
Good morning, John. Good to be here.
Lots from Jerome this morning. All morning, taxpayers are going to be looking at the bank that they're going to be owning soon. We'll look at what it means to us if our government actually ups its stake in Citigroup. We'll simplify all the confusing nuclear developments in North Korea. Femi Okeh, can you top that?
Oh, I certainly can. Good morning. Oh, good morning. John, I will with our commander-in-chief. President Obama takes over a chunk of prime time tonight for a speech. He will touch on a variety of topics, including healthcare and foreign policy, but finance will be a prime focus, including his goal to cut the budget deficit in half.
It will require us to make difficult decisions and face challenges we've long neglected. But I refuse to leave our children with a debt that they cannot repay.
The speech will be at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal will take a Mardi Gras break to deliver the Republican response. Before the big speech, the president meets with Japanese Prime Minister Taro Aso. He will be the first foreign leader to visit the Obama White House.
Let's hope the economy doesn't come up. There's a depressing subject, but it will be a big topic for the two leaders. North Korea's nuclear program will also be on the table. Today, North Korea says it's preparing a satellite launch. Satellites aren't usually noteworthy, but the whole region is now nervous because Pyongyang sometimes says satellite launch when it actually means missile test. In South Asia, a Taliban ceasefire in Pakistan could bear good and bad news. Militants controlling the volatile northwest say they'll extend a ceasefire to continue peace talks with the government. Pakistan says it could introduce Islamic law in the region bordering Afghanistan if militants stop fighting. The U.S. and other regional powers are wary.
We're standing by for several financial developments coming later this morning. New housing and consumer confidence numbers will be out, and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke testifies in the Senate.
They're looking for confidence on Wall Street. The Dow and S&P both sank yesterday, diving about 3.5%. The Dow is at its lowest point in the last 12 years. The S&P begins trading at 743. So with that in mind, we need a phrase to get us through 2009. What is your six-word motto? Tell us a motto for these troubled times at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Stephen Dubner, our Freakonomics pal, is going to be in this morning to judge those slogans and to give us a finalist. And actually, the people who have been weighing in on our website are actually very, very different than the ones that have been weighing in on the Freakonomics blog. Do you have a motto, Jerome? Femi had a great one yesterday.
I can't afford a motto.
That's good.
I can't afford a motto. That's five, Jerome.
That's
You're
pretty
one,
good.
One word short.
There's not enough money for that sixth word.
Mottos. Right. Who can afford them? Yeah, that's good. I like it. On The Takeaway, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Bouncing on the bottom, that's a viable theme for this morning on financial markets around the world and anticipating Wall Street's open, which may bounce off the bottom that it hit yesterday, but we won't know that for several hours. The bad news, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is at its worst point in almost 12 years. Not since 1997 have we seen the Dow Jones Industrial Average at 71 80 or so. The question, though, is what is the market reacting to? And, of course, the answer is very simple. It's reacting to the idea that the federal government perhaps has no choice but to nationalize the largest banks in the United States. And if you listen to the financial channels, you hear the word nationalization being talked with the moralizing sobriety of the term like cohabitation, perhaps, or fluoridation. The question of nationalization, is it a fact? Is it something involving morality? And does it actually involve the death of capitalism as we know it? Well, the only person to go to get clarity on this subject is Peter Morici, economist at the University of Maryland, who joins us from his home in Maryland. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. It's nice to be with you.
What do you make of this moralizing about nationalization good, nationalization bad? It seems to me almost a foregone conclusion based on the price of some of these stocks. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I don't think it is a foregone conclusion, but it is likely going to happen for two reasons. The federal banking policy just doesn't exist. If Timothy Geithner is competent, then as I've said in the past, I'll be playing point guard for the Detroit Pistons next season. And if Jamie Geithner is competent, I equally expect to be a rock star. Yesterday he cut his dividend by 87%, saying it'll help him repay the TARP. And in the next breath he said, but you know, we didn't need the TARP money anyway. Hey, if you didn't need the TARP any money anyway, why are you paying your lower executives bonuses? Why have you paid yourself all that money these years? And now you've got to stiff your shareholders.
You're talking about the president. You're talking about the president of J.P. Morgan Chase.
And they're supposed to be the healthiest bank. It sounds right. It's being run by a man that doesn't make any sense when he speaks.
All right. Well, let's take a couple of the details of some of the revelations yesterday apart. First of all, the federal government wants to do something called a stress test for banks. What would it test for, and how would a bank pass such a test?
Well, you're basically going to look at the risk involved and the assets on their books, their collateralized debt obligations, how bad they are. You know, are they really adequately valuing them? You know, mark-to-market kind of thing.
Well, let's talk about mark-to-market. You just said mark-to-market. I want to really be clear to our listeners of what they're talking about here.
Well, when mark-to-market means that you mark the securities at which you could sell them for now, under the notion that the market has some sense of how many defaults they're going to be. The banks have argued that they're undervaluing their securities, and that's half their problem. But, of course, they can't sell them to each other anything more than mark-to-market, so what does that tell you?
But the rules on mark-to-market basically mean if you have to value them at what they're priced at now, that means you have to put up reserves, cash reserves, to cover bad assets. And the banks are actually, they feel that that's too restrictive in this environment, right?
Yeah, well, they also didn't think they should be, you know, not paying bonuses was restrictive. You have to believe about one-third of what banker says, which is about half of what I believe about Obama's, you know. In any case, he gets two-thirds. And he's a politician. But what they would do then is compare that to what you're talking about, their reserves, their capitalization and things of that nature. And somebody like J.P. Morgan should sail through because they're in relatively good shape.
And Citigroup?
Citigroup might actually do better than we're anticipating simply because it's been run by the government for a while, and Vikram has been forced to get rid of a lot of his toys.
That would be Vikram Pandit, the CEO of Citigroup.
Yeah. The real problem is they're learning at Citigroup how difficult it is for the government to run a bank because they really don't have the expertise to do it.
Well, let's talk about what the definition of running a bank is versus owning a bank. There's a distinction between preferred stock and common stock. If the government actually infuses all of this cash into a bank like Citigroup or some of these others, are they acquiring common stock or preferred stock, and what does it do to the rest of the shareholders?
Well, right now they've been acquiring preferred stock. So theoretically, one would think that they are not acquiring the ability to influence governance of the bank. But the government as an owner is different than any other entity because the government is also your regulator. It is very hard to resist the government's influence at Citigroup if they are your line of credit of last resort, even if it comes in preferred shares. So you're making distinctions that don't have meaning when it comes to the government. The reality is that if they nationalize the banks, they won't necessarily run them. They would likely continue the management that they have, though they would give them greater oversight, much akin to what they've done with Citigroup, but not as severe, depending on the bank.
Is there a real viable scenario whereby they're nationalized for a couple of years and then they come back better than ever?
Well, Well, the basic problem here is you got to remove the bad assets from the books. Once the bad assets are gone, the banks are valuable again. Let's look at my favorite child, Citigroup. If you took away the bad assets through some mechanism, either working them out or getting them bad bank and so forth, then it's got deposits, it's got branches, it looks pretty good. You remove Vikram. I'm serious now. You replace the management with people that the public generally has confidence in, and some Midwestern bankers, and you can put that bank up for auction and find investors, and you can recapitalize it, and off it goes on its merry way. Essentially, that's what we do when we merge banks that get in trouble, or we during the savings and loan crisis. Similarly, so nationalization can be a temporary phenomenon. Or it can be permanent, depending on what you want to do.
All right, well, what about this idea? Some economists have talked about this, and actually Jerome Vaughan and I have been talking about this in our editorial meetings. Why not just forget some of these banks that have to undergo a stress test and basically focus on the regional banks, maybe some of the community-based banks that actually don't have any of these assets, give them the capital infusion. They have nothing to do with the money but lend it. It actually would accomplish what the Treasury says it wants to accomplish. And let the big banks just fend for themselves, for heaven's sakes.
You guys shouldn't practice economics so much in the director's room. Banks need more than capital to make loans. Banks are constrained in two ways by their making loans. One is their deposits and source of funds, and the other is how much capital they have. They can gear up 8-to-1 against their capital. But if you give a bank that's geared up 8-to-1 more capital, they can't make more loans unless they have more deposits or access to additional funds through securitization. And the basic problem in the banking system for the regional banks is not capital, but the inability to sell their loans to big New York banks and in turn have those bundled into bonds and sold to fixed income investors, where the cash is.
I see.
Okay?
I see.
That's the basic problem.
Right.
And that's
I detected there just a little bit of an insulting tone, though, on your part there.
Did you? I'm sorry.
We're not allowed to practice
economics.
Well,
now you know how Vikram feels. Of course, then again, I practice banking here from my house in Alexandria. So.
Yeah. Right. Until I have $200 million in the bank, I don't think I'm going to know how Vikram feels, Peter Maurice.
Because you're the richest man in radio.
Beautiful. Yeah, the bar is so high. Well, so we can't actually inflate the regional banks that are in, like, the Detroit area where Jerome hails from, and without having the big banks as a place for them to sell their loans to.
We've already tried that. We've pumped a lot of capital from the TARP into those banks, and it hasn't worked. Pumping capital into banks doesn't work. You see, normally, if you have one sick bank that's in trouble and it's important in a community, if you recapitalize it, it can make more loans because its problem was capital. But the whole banking system can't change because there's only so much deposits out there.
Right.
And so and over the last 30 years, banks not only went to securitization, but one of the reasons they did that is their depositors left. When the 50s and 60s, grandma had to put her money in the bank. In the 70s, grandma could put her money at Merrill Lynch in some kind of a money market fund, or she could buy one of those insurance policies that pays interest from a bank, a 5-year insurance policy was a bank account. And a lot of them did that. My mother had a whole bunch of money in that place before she died. So, I found out one after she passed.
So raising the we commemorate that somber moment, but again, the economics of it is not lost on us. Until the savings rate comes back, we're going to have fewer levers to pull in the banking industry.
Not
we're just going to have to hope. Not true.
Not true. Not true.
There's
plenty of cash for banks. There's plenty of cash out there, but it's over in the mutual funds. It's over in the insurance companies, pension funds, and places like that. They have fixed income money to invest, and historically they invested it in mortgage-backed securities. But right now they don't trust the New York banks to provide their service. To complete your earlier thought, what you'd like to be able to do is remove Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan from banking and replace them with regional banks that would provide that service. Get the larger regional banks into the securitization market and providing that service. And that's one of the things I've advocated that Bernanke had
done. All right. We got to go, Peter, but that's an interesting takeaway. Get the deposit money in the insurance area over into the regional banks somehow, but it's got to be confidence in the big banks to do it. Peter Maurice, economist at the University of Maryland, thanks, as always, for joining us.
Yeah. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.